It's March 23, 2003. The glamorous Kodak Theater in Hollywood, Los Angeles, buzzes with anticipation as the 75th Academy Awards unfold. The atmosphere is electric. The spotlight falls on the first award of the night, Best Animated Feature Film. Cameron Diaz, co-host for the evening, holds the envelope that contains the winner's name. Back then, the importance of this category wasn't fully realized. Animation wasn't held in the esteem it is today. Cartoons were often dismissed as merely, well, cartoons. This category was introduced just a year earlier, a change many attributed to the persistent lobbying of animation powerhouses Pixar and DreamWorks. Until then, animated masterpieces vied for the coveted Best Picture, but would frequently lose.
The theater hums with suspense as Diaz reads out the nominees. The lineup isn't surprising.
Ice Age.
With its $46 million opening weekend.
Lilo and Stitch.
Raking in $35 million.
Spirit, Stallion of the Cimarron.
A modest $17
million. Treasure Planet.
Which managed $12 million despite its reputation as a commercial failure that caused a combined loss of $30 million to its backers, including the formidable Walt Disney. Then there's the outlier.
Spirited Away.
By Hayao Miyazaki, a Studio Ghibli creation. It's a film that, with its $10 million earnings, lurked under the mainstream radar, overshadowed even by the underwhelming performance of Treasure Planet. The anticipation in the theater is palpable, as Diaz lingers for a moment before tearing open the envelope. With a soft smile, unexpected words spill from her lips.
Spirited Away, Hayao Miyazaki.
It's a result that sends a ripple of surprise through the audience. Adding to the enigmatic atmosphere, Miyazaki is not present to accept the award. And just as quickly as the unexpected victory comes, the focus shifts to the next category. Yet in that moment, something intangible shifts. The winds of change are unmistakably in motion. As time unfolds, Spirited Away by Studio Ghibli isn't just enduring, it's flourishing, weaving its spell beyond the borders of Japan. Eventually, its worldwide box office earnings surpass every other nominee for the award, amassing nearly $400 million globally. From 1UP Media, this is Empires, episode 1 of a 5-part series, Winds of Change. Most people aren't aware that Studio Ghibli originated from the collective genius of three seasoned friends in the industry. Isao Takahata, who was 50 at the time, Hayao Miyazaki at 44, and Toshio Suzuki, the youngest at 37. While Hayao Miyazaki is a name recognized globally, his colleagues Takahata and Suzuki were instrumental in the studio's success. Isao Takahata wasn't just Miyazaki Sr., but also the spark that ignited the creation of Studio Ghibli. He had identified Miyazaki's unique talent years earlier and was instrumental in nurturing Suzuki in film production. Takahata, acclaimed for his directorial skills, was at the helm of numerous Studio Ghibli masterpieces. Toshio Suzuki earned the title The Dark Wizard from none other than Miyazaki's own son. It was a tribute to Suzuki's persuasive prowess, his ability to navigate the team through pivotal projects and ensure accountability. Some contend that without Suzuki's relentless drive and tact, several films might never have seen completion. Suzuki emerged not just as the commercial face of Studio Ghibli, but also its steadfast producer.
At first glance, Studio Ghibli's financial figures might seem modest, especially when lined up against behemoths like Pixar Studios and Lucasfilms. Their box office earnings, while respectable, don't hit the astronomical highs of their counterparts. But there's a deliberate strategy behind those numbers that reveal a different kind of success. Studio Ghibli isn't in a race to maximize profits. Instead, they've carved a path marked by intentional restraint, specifically in the realm of merchandising. For context, franchises like Star Wars attribute a staggering 60% of their earnings to merchandise sales. Ghibli, on the other hand, has set strict boundaries to safeguard their iconic characters from commercial oversaturation. To put it in perspective, the revenue Ghibli generates from merchandising in certain years is only about a tenth of what Star Wars can make from merchandise tied to a single film. This approach, while admirable, is a source of tension among business partners who see the untapped potential for revenue, which some estimates peg at up to 20 times the restrictions set. Despite revealing this goldmine to the studio, they remain unyielding. Their rationale? A deeply rooted fear that excessive commercialization will diminish the essence of their characters.
This distinctive business ethos is also evident in Ghibli's marketing strategies. The release of The Boy and the Heron, potentially Miyazaki's swan song, is notably devoid of the customary promotional blitz. This isn't an oversight, but a calculated move to usher viewers into a cinematic experience untainted by preconceived notions, even if it means sidelining merchandising gains to preserve the film's intended aura.
The true essence of Studio Ghibli's influence isn't encapsulated in its financial reports or marketing strategies. It starts first with its name. Ghibli is derived from the warm wind originating from the Sahara, signaling an intention to stir a revolution in the Japanese animation industry. However, its impact has extended far beyond those initial aspirations. In the United States, the allure of Studio Ghibli first captivated influential creative minds, including John Lasseter, former chief creative officer of Pixar, and esteemed filmmaker Guillermo del Toro. Their endorsements paved the way for collaborations with renowned Hollywood actors for English dubbing, boasting names like Liam Neeson, Michael Keaton, Christian Bale, Kate Blanchett, and Anne Hathaway. The list surprisingly goes on and on.
Yet, recent years have seen speculations circle around the studio, particularly concerning its continuity. This follows Nippon TV's acquisition of a controlling stake in Studio Ghibli, prompting many to anticipate the studio's gradual fade. However, the reality is more intricate. Nippon TV and Studio Ghibli have shared a lengthy and collaborative relationship, with the former even inspiring the iconic film, Spirited Away. As we delve deeper, will navigate the intricate paths Studio Ghibli has tread. Meet the friends and collaborators who have joined this journey, and explore the unwavering creativity that has defined the studio. Starting with a man pivotal to the entire studio's inception.
Isao Takahata was born on October 29, 1935, in Ise, Mie Prefecture, Japan, a city graced by the presence of Ise Grand Shrine, the pinnacle of sanctity in the Shinto religion. For many, Ise symbolizes the heart of their faith. However, the city's revered status didn't shield it during World War II. In fact, it did the opposite. Allied forces, drawn by Ise's significance, unleashed a firebombing assault that transformed the sacred land into a harrowing battlefield. Takahata emerged from this ordeal scarred and with an unwavering conviction against war.
These experiences, carved into his psyche, would in time influence his creative expressions. Post-war, Takahata's academic pursuits led him to a degree in French literature, where he encountered the mesmerizing world of The King and the Mockingbird, a French animation that narrated literature like never before. This revelation enthralled Takahata, catapulting his profound fascination with animation, a passion that steered his journey to Toei Animation in 1959. Toei, established in 1948, was an animation behemoth with aspirations as grand as its creations, earning its nickname as the Disney of the East. The studio's prestige persists today, renowned for animating iconic series like One Piece and Dragon Ball Z. In Toei, Takahata would cut his teeth in directing as an assistant director for animated shows and films, becoming a force to be reckoned with.
It's now 1964, and things aren't looking good in Japan, especially at Toei. After the war, American forces pushed for big changes in Japan, promoting democracy and unions. It was a complete shift from Japan's pre-war structure. However, this newfound freedom led to a wave of protests across the nation, causing concern among the American occupiers. In response, they tried to rein things in with stricter control. But the Americans have left their mark, and unions have taken hold across Japan. Toei was no exception, especially with the company cutting costs at the expense of its workers. Employees were put through 90 hours of unpaid overtime each month, practically working 2 extra weeks without pay. Killer weeks became a common term, marking periods where everyone was expected to work extended hours. Married workers would stay until the last train, while singles often worked through the night. It was Toei's union that finally said enough. Armed with a list of 31 demands, they stood their ground. And Toei surprisingly agreed.
Miyazaki had just joined Toei as an in-between animator after the demands. In the world of animation, the head animator crafts the key frames, illustrating crucial scenes or moments signaling a shift in the narrative. On the other hand, in-between animators, like Miyazaki, are tasked with the meticulous job of filling in the sequences between these key frames. They produce multiple drawings to create fluid transitions, such as the animation of a walking character. But despite their role in bringing animations to life, they are often considered at the lower end of the animation hierarchy, focusing on the fluidity rather than the plot. To grasp the magnitude of their task, consider that achieving 1 second of smooth animation typically requires about 24 meticulously crafted frames. Prior to the union's intervention, an in-between animator's monthly earnings were a meager 5,000 yen, barely enough to make rent in Tokyo. But things had changed. Miyazaki now earned around 18,000 yen a month.
Cursed with a knowledge of the union's significance, Hayao Miyazaki was feeling nauseous at the announcement of his new role.
General Secretary of the Toei Labor Union.
With anxiety and apprehension clouding his thoughts, Miyazaki probably wondered,
how did I even get here?
Just a couple of months back, he met what he called
the face of a gentle and wise young man.
It was Isao Takahata. They exchanged pleasantries, and Miyazaki was surprised that Takahata was well aware of his work. Thinking he was simply a nice and friendly person, Miyazaki soon realized the complex duality of Takahata's character. In describing Takahata, Miyazaki's words are simple, dancing between admiration and warning.
Takahata is a scary person. Takahata was always very smart and cool. He has many enemies in Toei.
Nonetheless, Miyazaki found pleasure in his interactions with Takahata. But a swift change in circumstances found him joining the ranks of the Toei Animation Labor Union. Takahata stepped into the role of vice chairman, and Miyazaki, somewhat unexpectedly, became the general secretary. Suddenly, he was tasked with the complex duty of negotiating directly with Toei's highest executives. The irony wasn't lost on him. He was now sitting across the table from the very individuals who had given him his job in the first place.
I was really at a loss then,
Miyazaki would admit years later.
I had to take on responsibility.
In Japan, the concept of taking responsibility is amplified. It's not just about acknowledging an error. It entails stepping up to offer solutions and often shouldering the blame. In the corporate world of Japan, when a mistake is made, it's more than an error. It's a personal failing that often leads to resignation. This heightened sense of accountability, a cornerstone in Japanese culture, was now thrust upon Miyazaki.
You can see why it was a terrifying role. He wasn't just a creative mind anymore. He was a key figure, tasked with navigating the turbulent waters of corporate negotiations, where the specter of failure carried profound personal implications.
Yet one evening, amidst the pressures, a revelation struck Miyazaki. In the makeshift confines of the union office, deep in thought, he broke the silence, addressing Isao Takahata directly.
Baku-san,
Miyazaki called. Takahata was affectionately named Baku due to his habit of munching bread while walking, akin to the Pac-Man character.
Baku-san, I worry we're not realizing our potential with the work at Toei.
Takahata was lying down, barely getting up at his complaints. But Miyazaki could tell he was listening.
This new anime that we're working on, Doggy March, isn't making any sense to me. I don't get what we're producing. I think I actually even feel sick.
Doggy March was an anticipated comedy drama film because it was based on a manga by Osamu Tezuka, a man who would eventually be known as the Walt Disney of Japan. and the creative mind behind Astro Boy. Takahata gave Miyazaki an understanding look. He knew that Doggy March was tough. Rumor has it that the directors were working about 230 hours of overtime a month.
Miya-san.
He sighed.
I understand.
As the nights wore on, amid the enveloping pressures and in the hush of the wee hours, the bond between Miyazaki and Takahata deepened. United by their frustrations and a mutual longing for meaningful work, an unspoken agreement formed between them. If the right project presented itself, they would embrace it wholeheartedly, pouring in all their creativity and passion to bring it to life.
Miyazaki and Takahata will take some time to find the right project. In fact, we've got 2 years before they even discover it. In the meantime, if you're enjoying Empires, please give us a 5-star rating. It really helps the podcast. Done? Right on time. It's 1965, and by now, Miyazaki and Takahata had known each other for about 2 years. Word on the street is that Toei was losing their nerve. Mushi Productions, a new studio founded by Osamu Tezuka, the creator of Astro Boy, has entered the scene. They're offering salaries that are 2 to 3 times more generous than Toei's, positioning themselves as another Eastern counterpart to Disney. Their meteoric rise is fueled by the international success of Astro Boy, marking Mushi as the first Japanese studio to effectively export anime overseas. Amidst this, Disney is steadily making its presence felt in Japan. And in the midst of this competitive uproar, Toei Animation is feeling the heat. They decide to take a giant leap with a feature film, aiming for a masterpiece that would etch their name prominently on the global animation map. Their ambitious project is titled The Great Adventure of Horus, Prince of the Sun.
Initially, Toei's lead animator took the reins, frequently consulting Takahata for his invaluable creative insight. As time went on, it became increasingly evident that Takahata was destined to direct, playing a pivotal role in shaping the film. One day, amid their usual exchange of ideas and collaborative energy, something unusual catches Takahata's eye. A routine meeting is about to take an unexpected turn as he spots an enigmatic piece resting on the table before them. A drawing. Reaching out to it, he realizes it's a key frame for the movie. Uncertain, Takahata turns to the animator.
Is this yours? Actually, I wish it were mine, but no, it isn't.
They likely decide to overlook the mysterious occurrence. However, the next day brings a sense of déjà vu. A new keyframe appears. But this time, Takahata comes to a realization and calls Miyazaki in.
Reflecting on those moments years later, Miyazaki would reveal how he naively assumed his proximity to Takahata earned him a seat at the table. Without thinking too much, he simply kept drawing pictures that he thought suited the movie, leaving them in the meeting room unclaimed. As luck would have it, his anonymous contributions weren't just acknowledged, they were celebrated. Suddenly, Miyazaki, the in-between animator, found himself elevated, becoming an instrumental figure in crafting specific frames and landscapes for The Great Adventure of Horus, Prince of the Sun. His unassuming artistic expressions didn't just find a canvas. They would become the backdrop to Toei Animation's most ambitious project yet. But Miyazaki wasn't alone in this elevation. One by one, more talents were identified and pulled into the creative vortex of the film. With Takahata steering the ship, the film morphed into something akin to a movement. He didn't just seek to create a film. He was crafting an ideal, breaking from tradition. Where experience and seniority once dictated choice, Takahata endorsed merit and skill. The principle was simple. The best animator can come from anywhere and could contribute regardless of hierarchy.
As word spread of his unorthodox approach, it became a sore thumb to Toei. Never mind that Takahata was already disliked for being the union's leader. He was now bringing union behavior directly to work. Colleagues at the time recalled Takahata as an indomitable force, unyielding against the company's pressures and demands. By 1966, they started pre-production, and the team was excited. They were going to make something extraordinary, but not without paying an extraordinary price. Miyazaki would explain in the future.
He was trying to make a film on a different track from what had been made before. But there was a large gap between our aspirations and our abilities in terms of drawing the pictures. We struggled to bridge that gap as time kept passing.
The visionary spirit was alive, but experience, it turned out, counted significantly in large-scale productions, and the project faced delays. Every team member was pushed to their limits, including Miyazaki, who, even while hospitalized for appendicitis, continued to labor over the film's initial scenes. The team, now faced with ballooning production costs and a schedule that had long since spiraled out of control, was forced to adapt. Limited animation techniques were deployed, from reducing the number of frames per second to even simply panning left to right for others. The strain was incredible. Even Takahata, the project's firm leader, faced moments of despondence. On occasion, he'd spiral into lengthy monologues, reportedly for hours, dissecting the many challenges that threatened to derail their ambitious venture. Time seemed to drag on seemingly forever. Amid the extended production, Miyazaki experienced significant life events. He got married, welcomed his first son, and celebrated the child's first birthday.
Finally, on July 21, 1968, amid a maelstrom of emotions, The Great Adventure of Horus, Prince of the Sun, made its grand debut. But the reception was anything but grand. It was a film designed to captivate both children and adults, echoing the universal appeal of Disney creations. But it floundered, failing to grasp either demographic. A mere 10 days post-release, it was yanked from cinema screens. The Great Adventure of Horus was over. The Prince of the Sun dethroned. A project slated for a 10-month completion had extended into a 3-year odyssey. The financial toll, too, was severe, with Toei shelling out close to $2.3 million. Turning it to the most expensive Japanese animation of its time.
Yet in the shadow of initial failure, redemption loomed. Years later, audiences would revisit the film, recognizing an artistic and animation prowess that not only matched, but in certain scenes, surpassed Disney's esteemed benchmarks. For Miyazaki, the creation of Horace was a steep learning curve. He plunged into the depths of fast-moving animation and surfaced with a mastery of CinemaScope landscapes, skills that would lay the groundwork for Studio Ghibli's ascendancy. Takahata had a complex outcome after Horace. Although he lost favor at Toei, the hurdles and setbacks he encountered during the film's creation sharpened his skills and broadened his perspective. He earned a reputation for his slow, careful approach to animation. Miyazaki jokingly labeled him a giant sloth because of this, a nickname that held a mix of affection and apprehension. Behind the playful tease was Miyazaki's real concern. Each delay, the persistent slow pace of every project, fueled a worry about Takahata and the impact on their future collaborations. The tumultuous journey of creating Horus was a classroom for the entire team, each member walking away profoundly changed, their professional acumen deeply enriched.
Yet for Miyazaki and Takahata, the experience bore additional fruits. They discovered a synergy in their collaboration. With Miyazaki's fantastical imagination, beautifully counterpoised by Takahata's grounded realism, their professional paths remained intertwined over the next decade, each collaboration enhancing their mutual respect and understanding. Until 1978 brought an unexpected phone call that would alter their trajectory. The winds of change were upon them, and the pair would meet the final founder of Studio Ghibli, Toshio Suzuki. And together, they would create Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind. From 1UP Media, this is Empires, episode 1 of a 5-part series, Winds of Change. Next on Empires, you'll meet Toshio Suzuki, dubbed the Dark Wizard by Hayao Miyazaki's son. And together, we'll unveil how the trio breathed life into the legendary Studio Ghibli. Follow us so you won't miss out on episode 2 of our 5-part series, A Wizard's Call. Empires is a 1UP Media original, produced and edited by Guang Jin. Audio experience by Ethan Sam, and narrated by Luis Cruz and Claire Bernal. A quick word on our reenactments and dramatizations. While we can't know exactly what they say, think, or feel at the moment, it is all based on research. Thank you for listening.